As days passed on, I became considerably reconciled to Bartleby. His steadiness, his freedom from all dissipation, his incessant industry, except when he chose to throw himself into a standing reverie behind his screen, his great stillness, his unalterableness of demeanor under all circumstances, made him a valuable acquisition. One prime thing was this: he was always there, first in the morning, continually through the day, and the last at night. I had a singular confidence in his honesty. I felt my most precious papers perfectly safe in his hands. Sometimes, to be sure, I could not, for the very soul of me, avoid sudden spasmodic passions with him, for it was exceedingly difficult to bear in mind all the time these strange particularities, privileges, and unheard-of exemptions forming the tacit stipulations on Bartleby's part under which he remained in my office. Now and then, in the eagerness of dispatching pressing business, I would inadvertently summon Bartleby in a short, rapid tone to put his finger, say, on the insipid tie of a bit of red tape with which I was about compressing some papers. Of course, from behind the screen, the usual answer, "I prefer not to," was sure to come. And then, how could a human creature with the common infirmities of our nature refrain from bitterly exclaiming upon such perverseness, such unreasonableness?
HPPodcraft.com.
I often say, when it comes to jobs, that you teach people how to treat you. Like, what you put up with will instruct folks on how far they can push you or what they can ask of you. And it seems Bartleby has taken this advice to heart here. He refuses to tie a ribbon, and his boss is mad, but then never again asks him to tie a ribbon. So it worked.
Chad, I don't want to do the foot rubs anymore.
Welcome to the H.P. Lovecraft Literary Podcast. I'm Chad Pfeiffer.
I'm Chris Lackey.
We're here at HPPodcraft.com covering the second part of Bartleby the Scrivener by Herman Melville. Who was that reader?
That was Wyatt S. Gray, comedian, voice actor, and all-around regular guy. You can learn more about Wyatt at WyattComedy.com. We will link out in the show notes eventually.
We're still catching up on show notes and tagging on our new Patreon page, and there are a lot of episodes to fill in, but we will get there. Unlike Bartleby, we are doing the work.
For our patron subscribers, we hope you enjoyed our first comment show, Kool-Aid Manning.
My favorite football player.
Please continue to let us know what you think about anything.
Send in those comments, and we'll be releasing a Hot Topic show next week. We haven't recorded that yet. Now, this month, there is a fifth Thursday, which means we get a week off, sort of. The Topic show will come out early next week, but our regular show, it'll be another week after that, because we're going to be off. I'm actually going back to Illinois for some nephew graduations, which will be fun.
Wow.
Always a great occasion because school is kind of a drag, but at the same time, look at all these kids about to be crushed by the working world.
Yeah.
Welcome to it. Here's your diploma. Now get out there. That's actually why those graduation caps are flat. That's the reason, is to symbolize the beginning of the crushing. Yeah.
This story was recommended by Kiran Setia, author of Midlife, a philosophical guide, available now.
And by the way, that whole teach people how to treat you thing, it's worked for me a few jobs, but that's because I'm a white guy.
Oh, right.
I was expounding on this. I had a female coworker who was like, "That's great, but the hill I have to die on is, will people actually listen to one or two sentences from me in a row?"
Oh.
Basic respect is what a lot of folks are fighting for in the workplace.
Yeah.
Still not a level playing field, so keep that in mind. My advice is restricted to my experience, and I don't really know what I'm talking about. But this will all be in my short story, Bartlebet the Scrivenette. Quick summary. Bartleby is a clerk at a law office for a somewhat lazy boss. He's been asked to do a few tasks and refused to do them and hasn't suffered any consequences for that decision. It is somewhat easy for the boss to justify doing nothing, though, because as we heard in the opening, Bartleby is at the job day and night, super reliable in the work he does do. So, heck, let's just pretend he's a specialist and give the other work to the dummies who will do it, and that would be Turkey, Nippers, and Gingernut, the other employees. That's basically where we are. Are you eating a Gingernut right now?
I am eating a Gingernut right now.
Mm.
A friend of the show, Greg Johnson, came over Friday night, and he goes, "Here you go." And he just handed me a packet of ginger nut biscuits.
Are they good?
They're really spicy. If you like ginger, yeah, they're great. They're just like little, they're good for dipping in your coffee or your tea or whatever.
All right.
And so, you know, I figured while we're doing the story, I'm going to enjoy a little ginger nut.
Mm, that'll be great to listen to. Riveting.
The lawyer, the narrator of the story, brings up that he has four keys to the office. One for the cleaning lady, one for himself, one for Turkey. But the last one, he doesn't really remember where it is.
He assumes one of the others in the workplace has it, but yeah, it doesn't seem like a very secure
no.
workplace.
So one Sunday morning, the lawyer is stopping by the office unexpectedly and goes to unlock the door, but there's a key already in the door on the other side. Someone comes to the door, opens it, it's Bartleby. And he says, I'm very busy with work right now, and I would prefer not to let you in. And then he goes on to say that the lawyer...
It's his office.
Yeah, his own office that he owns. The boss.
Yeah.
And he says, why don't you just take a walk or two around the block, and then I'll be done doing what I'm doing. And then he just closes the door, and then the lawyer does. He does just as yeah. Bartleby wanted him to do.
And when he opened the door, Bartleby was in his shirt sleeves, meaning no jacket, and it said, and a strangely tattered dishabille. Had to look dishabille up. It means the state of being only partly or scantily clothed, which is a pretty cool sounding vocabulary.
Yeah.
So I'm glad I learned that. But obviously, he's just going about his Sunday morning, probably a cereal bowl on the table, some cartoons playing in the background. What's going on here?
The lawyer walks around and decides that he's going to get some answers. But when he returns, Bartleby is just gone. He looks behind the screen, deduces that Bartleby must be living there. Now, there isn't any obvious signs, but when he starts kind of poking around a bit, there's an old sofa that looks a little bit more worn than it should, and there's a blanket that he finds and a tin basin. Now, instead of getting angry about this, this really bums the lawyer out. He thinks about how sad and lonely Bartleby must be.
Yeah, it's really sad. You know, during the week, Wall Street and this office is hustling and bustling, but here on a Sunday, it's a lonely place, it's dead, and Bartleby's just hanging out waiting for things to start up again. I only think it's cool to sleep where you work if you're a private detective. Otherwise... it's always going to be depressing. And this sadness infects the narrator. And as we said in the last episode, he has this enviable lightness about him. He just wants to have an easy life, goof off.
Yeah.
And he says, for the first time in my life, a feeling of overpowering, stinging melancholy seized me. Before, I had never experienced aught but a not unpleasing sadness. The bond of a common humanity now drew me irresistibly to gloom. Mm. The scrivener's pale form appeared to me laid out among uncaring strangers in its shivering, winding sheet.
Mm.
This section seemed really important to me. I think there are heavy themes of depression in this story.
Mm.
Possibly Bartleby, with his slow shedding of tasks, is the actual characterization of depression. I mean, he's already given up a home. Mm. He's here alone, so he's given up friends and society. Slowly, he's going to lose the will to do anything at all. This revelation in the mind of the narrator kind of points to the notion that we're not really paying attention to the folks around us most of the time.
Hmm.
You know, are there people in our lives, in our workplace, school, family, that are slowly isolating themselves and we're not noticing?
Hmm.
He thinks, happiness courts the light, so we deem the world as gay. But misery hides aloof, so we deem that misery there is none.
The lawyer looks in Bartleby's desk and finds this handkerchief that is tied up, and he opens it and there's just a ton of money inside of it, and he realizes that it's Bartleby's savings.
Yeah, so he's got some money, but he's not even spending it. And so he thinks, well, what does he even do outside of work when I think about it? He's never seen him reading, not even a newspaper.
Mm-hmm.
There are long periods where he stands looking out of his window, but there's just a brick wall behind it.
Yeah.
He never goes anywhere in particular. He never even goes out for a walk. And then there's some really profound stuff here. It says, his pity turns to repulsion. The narrator thinks, so true it is, and so terrible too, that up to a certain point, the thought or sight of misery enlists our best affections. But in certain special cases, beyond that point, it does not. They err who would assert that invariably this is owing to the inherent selfishness of the human heart. It rather proceeds from a certain hopelessness of remedying excessive inorganic ill.
Yeah.
So it's like there's a point where you feel bad for somebody, and then there's a point past that where you think, what the hell can I do?
Yeah.
Yeah, you know, this guy is way too far gone.
And it makes you feel bad because you feel helpless and you feel like there's nothing that you can do.
Yeah, it leads to a sort of repulsion. I don't even want to look at that because I can't do anything about it. So why am I letting it torture me?
The lawyer believes that Bartleby is suffering from a disorder of some kind.
It was his soul that suffered, and his soul I could not reach. This is such great psychology going from, oh my God, he lives there. It's so sad. This is making me feel like I haven't done enough to, well, what the hell am I supposed to do about it? This is his fault.
Mm-hmm.
He decides he's got to stop the pity, ask Bartleby some questions, and if it doesn't turn out right, he's going to give him some severance and cut him loose.
Yeah.
Of course, we've seen these conclusions before.
So come Monday morning, the lawyer tries to talk to Bartleby. He says, I'm not going to ask you to do anything you would prefer not to do. I simply wish to speak to you. Bartleby just doesn't respond to him. He goes, will you tell me, Bartleby, where were you born? And he goes, I would prefer not to. And he goes, will you tell me anything about yourself? I would prefer not to. And he goes, but what reasonable objection can you have to speak to me? I feel friendly towards you. And then Bartleby's response is, at present, I prefer to give no answer. Not going into a blind fury like I think I might in this particular circumstance. Mm. He just doesn't want to upset Bartleby, so he drops it.
Still, it stings him. He thinks his perverseness seemed ungrateful, considering the undeniable good usage and indulgence he had received from me.
But Nippers overhears this, and since it's morning, he's the one that's in a bad mood. He wants to know what Bartleby is wiggling out of. The lawyer says, I would prefer that you would withdraw for the present. The lawyer is using the I prefer.
Yeah.
It's kind of infecting him a bit. But then Turkey wants to know what's going on. So everybody's crowding around Bartleby's desk, and Bartleby says, I would prefer to be left alone here. So everybody starts pointing out, oh, well, you would prefer, well, I would prefer this, I would prefer that. So
yeah.
Everybody in the office kind of starts getting on this whole I prefer thing because it's working for Bartleby.
Well, they're just interjecting the word in it because he says, Turkey, come on, would you please get out of here? And he says, oh, certainly, sir, if you prefer that I should. So it's like they're all using this word now, and it cracked me up because outside of the story, it's such a human thing when you pick up language and you don't necessarily even want to pick it up.
Sure.
Like I play video games with a couple of my friends, and every time something happens, I'll go, oh, snap! I don't say that. I don't even know where I picked it up. I've heard it a few times. I kept saying it. I go, why did I say that? I sent a text to one of those friends the other day, and he wrote me back, and he goes, oh, snap! And I know he thinks it's dumb, too. So why are we saying it? It's just some things just get in there, and you start spitting them out without meaning to.
It totally happens. The lawyer is seeing the upset Bartleby is causing, and he starts to think that maybe he should fire Bartleby, what he's been saying all along. Of course, he doesn't want to do it right away.
Yeah, I thought it prudent not to break the dismission at once, right? It doesn't explain why.
Yeah.
It's just procrastination.
Yeah.
Doesn't want to deal with it.
The next day, the lawyer notices that Bartleby is not doing any kind of work, just staring out the window. When he confronts him, he says that he has decided not to write anymore. And when he asks why, he says, don't you see? The lawyer looks at Bartleby and he deduces that there's something wrong with his eyes. He's overworked. That's the conclusion that he comes to.
He thinks maybe all the concentration has impaired Bartleby's vision. We have made some fun of this narrator for his indecisiveness and lack of courage, but he really is trying hard to help this guy.
Yeah.
I mean, there is a part, he is concerned about him, and that's wrapped up in it too. It says, I urged him to embrace the opportunity of taking wholesome exercise in the open air. Of course, Bartleby doesn't want to do that.
Mm.
He thinks, all right, we'll take it easy for a while, and hopefully the vision will come back, and then he'll be working again.
It's strange. It's almost, there's shades of an abusive relationship as well here, where he's
sure.
bending over backwards to try and make things work and make it not be Bartleby's fault. But Bartleby is not doing his job.
Oh, that's interesting. I didn't think of it that way. Yeah, you're right.
He got hired to do something and he's not doing it. Now he's still getting paid, but doesn't have to work. He's living there, doesn't have to pay any rent.
Yeah.
It's strange. I don't know if that is the intent of it, but it's something, especially just talking about it now, it came to mind.
Well, I think it's definitely there. And I know, and I went through a situation similar to this. I had an employee who wasn't very good at her job, and I kept reducing her tasks until she was doing the only thing that she liked to do. And the rest of the editors that worked for me were really mad about it. So I've been in this exact position actually, yeah. And kind of understand, but she was abusing the fact that I was being nice over and over and over,
mm-hmm.
and using it to her advantage. Later, I would discover, kind of with some knowledge, she was purposely not doing some things right.
So
I think you're right.
Over the next few days, Bartleby continues not working and looking more sickly. He does not work, and the lawyer has to pick up his slack. When asked when he might get back to copying, he said he's given up on copying for good.
And I feel like this is the necessary escalation of the conflict for the story.
Oh, yeah.
You can justify anything else, but when he finally is like, I'm not going to do anything,
yeah.
We are now at a place where it has to be dealt with.
But the lawyer is worried about him. It's not, he's not getting angry about this. He's just concerned about this guy. But finally tells Bartleby he has 6 days to be out of the office. However, he offers to help him find a place to live and will help him any way he can. At the end of the 6 days, Bartleby is still there. He tells Bartleby he must now leave, and he responds, I would prefer not. And finally, the lawyer says, you must. But he just is silent. He doesn't say anything. So the lawyer owes him $12, and then he puts down $32 on the desk, which Bartleby won't take. So he just leaves it on the table. He tells Bartleby to remove his things and slide the key under the door on his way out. Then the lawyer leaves. I don't know why he thinks he would leave.
Well, he's just tricking himself, you know?
Yeah.
And he actually puffs some stuff. He goes, man, I'm really cool the way I handled that. Gave him the little $20 severance, and I didn't have to confront him. I just said, leave your key. I didn't even have to watch him go out with his box or anything. Mm-hmm. He's walking around going, I could not but highly plume myself on my masterly management in getting rid of Bartleby. There was no vulgar bullying, no bravado of any sort.
Mm. The next day, the lawyer comes back to the office, and of course, Bartleby is still there.
And not only is he still there, he won't even let him in. The lawyer's fumbling with the doormat. Where's that key he should have left for me? He bumps into the door, and then from within, Bartleby says, not yet, I am occupied. That is pure comedy. So funny. This description, he goes, I was thunderstruck. And then he goes on to actually explicate what that means. For an instant, I stood like a man who, pipe in mouth, was killed one cloudless afternoon long ago in Virginia by a summer lightning. At his own warm, open window, he was killed and remained leaning out there upon the dreamy afternoon till someone touched him when he fell. That's what it's like to be thunderstruck. But it also reminded me of the lurking fear.
Oh, yeah.
Remember, there's the guy who's leaning out the window.
Yeah.
They come over and go, "Hey, what's going on, buddy?" And then he falls over and he's got no face. So that's how the boss feels.
Well, finally, when Bartleby lets him in, he goes, "I am seriously displeased. I am pained, Bartleby. I thought better of you." And then no response. "Will you or will you not quit me?" And then, of course, Bartleby says, "I would prefer not to quit you."
Which was actually the first version of the line in the script for Brokeback Mountain. But they rewrote it because it wasn't as impactful. "I prefer not to quit you." Didn't work in testing.
The lawyer asks if he's ready to work now, but Bartleby doesn't respond. The lawyer is getting so angry that he's ready to beat Bartleby's ass. Like, it's bringing him to physical desires, you know, as in a violence, not to kiss him. Or maybe, no. But he remembers a story where a guy got angry, attacked another guy, and actually ended up killing him. So he remembered his Bible verse to love one another.
And that case that he's talking about there, that was a very dramatic case in New York in, I believe, the 1840s. It was the case of John C. Colt. Colt, he was the brother of Samuel Colt, the gun manufacturer.
Oh.
This is a wealthy, big-name family. And after a number of his own ventures, John Colt became an authority on double-entry bookkeeping, and that was the business that he went after. So he published a textbook on the subject, which was kind of the how to do your balance sheets, basically.
Right.
It went through 45 editions, remained in continuous publication even 13 years after John C. Colt's death.
Wow.
But here's the interesting thing. I'm grabbing this from Wikipedia. In 1842, Colt was convicted of the murder of a printer named Samuel Adams, to whom Colt owed money over the publication of a bookkeeping textbook. Colt killed Adams with a hatchet the previous year in what he claimed was self-defense, but he had afterwards covered up the crime by disposing of the body. Did a little further research, and his disposal technique was he crated the corpse up and tried to ship it to New Orleans. I don't know what would have happened when it got there.
What?
Yeah, he was just trying to ship it out of New York. When the body was discovered, Colt was the first suspect. The trial became a sensation in the New York press because of his family connections, the manner of disposal, and Colt's somewhat arrogant demeanor in the courtroom. I think this stuff is thematically kind of related to the story.
Mm-hmm.
Colt was found guilty and sentenced to hang in 1842, but committed suicide on the morning of his execution. Conspiracy theories circulated about the suicide, with some holding that Colt had in fact escaped from prison and staged a body to look like his own. One publication alleged that a family member smuggled the knife used in the suicide into his cell. Others stated that Colt was living in California with his wife, Caroline. None of these allegations were ever proven. Edgar Allan Poe may have based a short story, The Oblong Box, partly on the murder of Adams, and Herman Melville alluded to the case in his novella, Bartleby the Scrivener.
Still not sure how to deal with this. The lawyer leaves the office.
He starts to think of this situation. Maybe it's something that has been thrust upon him by an all-wise providence, that this is some kind of challenge that's gifted him by God. He's really justifying to himself.
Sure.
At this point, you know, he thinks, "Yes, Bartleby, stay there behind your screen. I shall persecute you no more. You are harmless and noiseless as any of these old chairs. In short, I never feel so private as when I know you are here. At last I see it. I feel it. I penetrate to the predestinated purpose of my life. I am content. Others may have loftier parts to enact, but my mission in this world, Bartleby, is to furnish you with office room for such period as you may see it fit to remain."
He's in love with him.
Well, it's like he adopted a squirrel or something. He's like, I've found this purpose in my life. I'm going to take care of this animal selflessly.
Oh, golly.
And he's doing this, and he feels good about it, even though visiting lawyers are totally bagging on him for it, you know.
Mm-hmm.
It says, "All through the circle of my professional acquaintance, a whisper of wonder was running round, having reference to the strange creature I kept at my office. All these dark anticipations crowded upon me more and more, and my friends continually intruded their relentless remarks upon the apparition in my room. A great change was wrought in me. I resolved to gather all my faculties together and forever rid me of this intolerable incubus." So peer pressure gets to him eventually, even
sure,
though he's decided this is his, you know, divine purpose.
Anyway, the lawyer gives him another 3 days, but again, Bartleby doesn't go.
"Having taken 3 days to meditate upon it, he apprised me that his original determination remained the same." So he's like, "You got to leave in 3 days. He goes, "I took the 3 days to think about it." No.
So the lawyer gets this idea that he's going to move offices. And I thought, this is funny to me. I'm like,
yeah.
But then he does. He actually warns Bartleby, telling him to make proper arrangements. Mm-hmm. And then he does it. I couldn't believe it. In the story, it's like, what's going on? He gets men to come in, move everything out. The screen, of course, is the last thing that is taken. And when they take it away, Bartleby just stands there in the completely empty office.
So bizarre. And I wonder how many people have moved because they can't handle conflict. The neighbors are playing music too loud. I just don't want to go over there. The guy looks kind of strong. Let's move. You know, that must have happened many times.
It must have happened.
Yeah.
So he says goodbye to Bartleby and tries to slip him some money, which Bartleby just drops to the floor. And then he leaves. The next few days, the lawyer thinks about Bartleby. He thinks maybe he's going to show up in the new office, but he doesn't. A guy, though, shows up and asks the lawyer if he's the one who used to have the offices over on Wall Street. And he says, oh, yeah, that's me. And he goes, well, look, we've got this guy and you're responsible for him. He's still there. He won't do anything. He won't work. He just stands around. And the lawyer says, I fired him, so he's no responsibility of mine. And the guy says, okay, fine, I'll go take care of it. And the guy leaves. A few weeks go by, and then there's a crowd at his new offices when he comes into work. The guy from before and the landlord of the building are there, and they are imploring the lawyer to do something about Bartleby.
They turned him out of his room, and he now persists in haunting the building generally, sitting upon the banisters of the stairs by day and sleeping in the entry by night.
The lawyer is concerned that this might blow back on him and sully his reputation in the papers, so he says he'll see what he can do. He finds Bartleby at the landing in the offices. He tells Bartleby, either you're going to have to do something or something will be done to you. And the lawyer offers him a job somewhere else. Like maybe you could be a bartender, like, you know, just goes to this whole litany of other jobs that he can do. And of course, all of them, Bartleby says that he prefers not to.
Finally, the lawyer gets mad. And then what he says is pretty dumb. He says, stationary you shall be then. If you do not go away from these premises before night, I shall feel bound. Indeed, I am bound to quit the premises myself. It's like, great. You haven't been here for 2 weeks. What does it matter? Go ahead and leave. It doesn't even make sense. If you don't leave, then I'm gonna. Okay. It reminded me of that time your dad yelled at you when I was over at your house. I know you know what I'm talking about.
I know what you're talking about.
Because you, hey, if you keep leaving the comics out of their plastic in the bathroom, they're going to get wet. And you go, those aren't my comics. I don't keep them in the bathroom. And he goes, well, if I see him again, I'm going to throw water on him. And you go, okay. And then he left and stormed out. It was, man, that was the greatest argument I've ever seen in my life. They're your comics, Dad. Go ahead.
Anyway, he offers Bartleby a place to stay in his home. Again, he prefers not to. So, I mean, my God, he was going to take him into his home.
Yeah.
So the lawyer runs out of the office there. I mean, he runs out of the office and just gets away. And then he goes back to his new office and tells Nippers to take over the business for a few days as he goes out of town. Yeah. And he feels a sense of relief as he does because he just needed to get away from all of that.
Yeah, maybe if I get away for a while, this will take care of itself.
So when the lawyer gets back, there is a letter on his desk from the landlord saying that he called the police and they took Bartleby away to prison. They want the lawyer to come down to the prison and make a statement. The lawyer goes down and gives his account of what happened, saying that Bartleby was an honest man, just eccentric. It turns out since Bartleby is so chill that they let him kind of wander around this outdoor courtyard, he just sort of stands around out in this courtyard at the prison when he's not in his cell. The lawyer goes down to see him, but Bartleby wants nothing to do with him, has nothing to say to him. This big guy in an apron comes up to the lawyer and he asks, are you friends with Bartleby? And he says, oh yeah. And the guy says, well, I'm the grub man. People pay me to make food for the inmates. The lawyer gives him some money and he asks to make sure that Bartleby would get the best food that he can get in his circumstance. And the grub man asks the lawyer to introduce him to Bartleby. After the introduction, Bartleby turns down the food as it would disagree with him. He's not used to eating dinners, he says. Yeah. The grub man says, boy, this Bartleby's an odd one, isn't he? And the lawyer says, well, I think he is deranged. The lawyer leaves, and in a few days, he comes back to the prison to see Bartleby, but he's not in his cell. A guy said he saw him sleeping in the yard. And he just laid down like 20 minutes ago. The lawyer finds Bartleby lying in the fetal position with his eyes open, and he is dead. The end of the tale.
And at the beginning, the narrator says there was one piece of info he did get about the mysterious Bartleby. Nothing was known about him, but he said this piece of information will be revealed in the sequel, i.e. this little note at the end of the story.
Here, I hardly know whether I should divulge one little item of rumor, which came to my ear upon a few months after the scrivener's decease. Upon what basis it rested, I could never ascertain, and hence, how true it is, I cannot tell now. But inasmuch as this vague report has not been without certain strange, suggestive interest to me, however sad, it may prove the same with some others. And so I will briefly mention it. The report was this, that Bartleby had been a subordinate clerk in the dead letter office at Washington, from which he had been suddenly removed by a change in the administration. When I think over this rumor, I cannot adequately express the emotions which seize me. Dead letters! Does it not sound like dead men? Conceive a man by nature and misfortune, prone to a pallid hopelessness. Can any business seem more fitted to heighten it than that of continually handling these dead letters and assorting them for the flames? For by the cartload they are annually burned. Sometimes from out of the folded paper the pale clerk takes a ring, the finger it was meant for, perhaps, molders in the grave. A banknote sent in swiftest charity, he whom it would relieve nor eats nor hungers any more. Pardon for those who died despairing, hope for those who died unhoping, good tidings for those who died stifled by unrivaled calamities. On errands of life, these letters speed to death. Ugh, Bartleby. Ugh, humanity.
And that's the end of the story. So, what's the significance of these dead letters?
I think that maybe Bartleby is in a sense a dead letter. Mm-hmm. He doesn't have anywhere to go. He has nothing to do. So he's just sort of ended up in a place that he doesn't really want to be, or he's not supposed to be. There really is nothing for him. I could be wrong. What do you think it means?
Just from a really surface level place, if you have an incredibly depressing job over time, it can probably really get to you. Maybe even take away your will to live when you see. The way that he describes it there, it's like you're dealing with the futility of life every day. There's money coming in for people who could need it, but they're dead. Mm-hmm. And there's all these dreams and things, and the letter is there treating this person like they're alive, but they're gone. And I think that just over time, if you've ever known anybody that's worked in psychological care for a long time, or maybe, you know, a job where you have to deal with really troubled people for a long time, there's a lot of danger that you'll burn out.
Sure.
And get depressed yourself. And I think maybe, on the surface level, that's it. But I think you're closer that there's another meaning to it. I mean, maybe he himself is a dead letter, or maybe dead letters represent, he starts to see the whole world this way. It's all futile. Mm. Why bother copying these notes? They're going to eventually, you know, they're all addressed to people who will eventually die. Mm-hmm. This work is really not purposeful.
So is this story weird?
I think absolutely. Just simply because you have a character, well, we just never learn anything about him. Everything we think about him is based on assumptions that we're making.
I mean, it could just be that he's just a strange, depressed man, and that's all. But it could be that he is a Yithian traveling through time.
Well, I don't know. I mean, I don't know if you need monsters or anything like that for something to be weird. I think that you need normal life to be intruded on by something entirely abnormal.
Yeah.
That makes you reconsider everything.
Other.
Maybe I'm wrong about what that maybe I'm extending the definition too much, but I feel like he's breaking social conventions to such a high degree that it has these profound effects on the people around him, particularly this narrator.
In such a strange way as well. It's not like he's just wrecking stuff or being violent towards people. He's doing this really subtle, strange kind of disobedience, which is not seen in society usually. So for me, weird is a feeling. It's an uneasiness in the unknown aspects of a story. And for me, this made me feel uneasy in that weird way.
Definitely.
So I would say it's definitely weird.
And like we said at the beginning, the main character really is the narrator. And if we go down the path that Bartleby doesn't even exist, if this is just a psychological examination, perhaps it's that the lawyer is every day getting up and he's going to do these tasks and he's looking at them and thinking, I would really prefer not to do this.
Yeah.
And then he jostles himself into some kind of justification for getting it done. And then he moves on and it's just getting harder and harder and harder. So in that respect, Bartleby might not, he's a ghost, or he's a figment of, he's like a psychological problem made real.
Right.
I don't know if that makes it weird either, but that's a possibility.
Yeah. And there's also an element to it where Bartleby seems to me like he's trying to reclaim power in a way. Mm-hmm. Like by him not putting up with the rat race. He's, you know, he's slowly kind of eking his way out of it. And so that's sort of something that a lot of people want to do. You want to get out of it. You don't want to do all this stupid work. You want to just hang out. But what he does when he gets out of it is nothing. Like he just, as far as we know, he just stands and stares into space. Mm-hmm. So that, is that saying that the rat race is really all there is?
Maybe. In my heart, I really feel this is Melville expressing a depression about not being able to get money for the things he wants to do.
Mm.
I feel it's the stress of not doing what you love and having to exchange your time for money in order to eat. It can lead to a pretty deep depression,
right,
and a loss of interest in things that you used to enjoy because of that conflict. And I was thinking about that, and you know, Melville and Hawthorne were friends,
right?
And they wrote letters to each other. Those letters are really fascinating. In one of them, Melville writes to Hawthorne, "What I feel most moved to write, that is banned. It will not pay. Yet altogether write the other way, I cannot. So the product is a final hash, and all my books are botches."
Mm.
So this is what he was running into all the time, is he'd start something out in some of his novels. He'd start out as a racy sea story, that's kind of thing that people expected from him,
right,
after his first couple of books. And then he'd start becoming interested in, oh, maybe this guy's an atheist, or there, you know, he'd start bringing in concepts, or he'd give up some of the more sensational forms of writing for more literate types of pursuits. And that's when people would fall out and hate the book. Mm-hmm. So he couldn't explore the stuff he wanted to do. The stuff that they would pay him to do, he hated doing.
Right.
And it really started to depress him and make him feel like his work was irrelevant and worthless. And I really see that in here.
Yeah.
The way that Bartleby slowly is cutting off all of these things. You know, and when you look biographically at Melville, look, some point I really would like to do Moby Dick on this show. I've never read it.
Wow.
I don't know if it's conceivable, because I know it's a pretty big book, but a lot of folks who have read it go, come on, guys, this is pretty Lovecraftian, actually. But Melville himself had a similar background to Lovecraft. He was from a wealthy family.
Oh.
He's got a long lineage that goes all the way back to royalty on both sides. His father was pretty rich, but was making bad bets, not gambling, but I mean making bad bets on business,
right,
and eventually lost the family fortune. And Melville became this sort of poor cousin to a lot of other wealthy people.
Oh.
Very similar to Lovecraft, where he was always looking back and going, God, if I had just kept that,
yeah,
social standing, but I have to work. I have to go and do this stuff.
Mm.
In his heart, he was a patrician, but then he was faced with this plebeian life, and that tortured him as well.
I think. Boo-hoo.
Of course, boo-hoo. Look, none of us can live anybody else's lives. And
that's true.
For him, I think it was a particular struggle. So.
Of course.
And I think it really is articulated well in the story.
You know, this show is a struggle for our listeners.
A struggle for them to get through it, you mean?
To have to listen to us talk about all this stuff every week.
Yeah, maybe it's true.
And they are not unlike the lawyer, and they keep giving us money, these Patreon supporters.
even though we fail every step of the way. Hey, I'd like to know who some of those supporters are, to be honest.
I can tell you some of these supporters, and why don't you give me a few, too?
All right, well, I know there's Pat Kovacic.
I know there is Hummets.
Cynthia Clark.
Bruce.
Just one name, Bruce.
Bruce.
Glad you grabbed it up. There's Joseph Nani.
Keith Allison.
James DeBrooker.
Not too Cthulhu.
I'm sure that's his given name, or hers. Ryan Douglas Macy.
And Clara Meath.
Thank you all so much for contributing to the Patreon. We're continuing to grow the service there, and I hope more of you who are subscribers on Witch House Media will jump over. I want to thank our reader for today, Wyatt S. Gray.
Oh my God, he's so good.
I also want to thank the suggester of this story, Kieran Setia. Please pick up his philosophy books. Next up, I believe we're going to take on the story Mimic by Donald A. Wolheim.
Yes, it was a listener suggestion.
It's also the basis of the Guillermo del Toro film.
I didn't realize that.
That's what we're going to be talking about. Remember, that will be in June, coming out around the 7th or 8th. Next week, you will get the special Hot Topic show.
Yeah.
Maybe even we'll talk about the story Hot Topic. I don't know what it's going to be about. But that'll be coming out early in the week, and then we'll be off the rest of that week. Thanks so much for tuning in, folks. I am Chad Pfeiffer.
And I'm Chris Lackey, and you've been listening to the H.P. Lovecraft Literary Podcast.
At hppodcraft.com.
hppodcraft.com.